So things can only become better once you've got an Ig Nobel. Maybe. I still have to figure out what depths we can get to. All right, so what I want to tell you about is some work which has actually been occupying us on and off for, I guess, the best part of a decade, and in fact has connections to people over here. To Will Rue, in fact, I think one of the first things that he worked on more than a decade ago was something that I'll talk about a little bit towards the end of the talk. But really, the idea that I wanted to get across is that if you look at fairly simple physics and not so simple geometry, you essentially are able to explain an enormous number of phenomena which scale many orders of magnitude. So geometric mechanics is what I want to tell you about, and as a way to begin, here are some images. So these, if I didn't tell you the scale, you wouldn't know where they were, whether they were on the back of your hand or on your forehead or somewhere else, but of course it gives it away when I show you the scale of it. It's 10 kilometers, and these are essentially a range of mountains in the Karakoram, northwest of India and Pakistan. And what you can see is a rough pattern of wrinkles with a spacing of the order of a few kilometers, but essentially over a scale which can actually carry on for hundreds of kilometers. And as I said, if I didn't tell you the scale, that wouldn't be too dissimilar from what you actually see at the back of your hand. So over here you have a thin crust, and that crust is essentially being deformed irreversibly because of the forces from the mantle and also from the collision between India and Asia, which a lot more, on which I'm sure there are a lot more experts over here than I ever will be. Here is an example on a much smaller scale, from 10 kilometers down to a few centimeters at the back of one's hand. With age, you essentially start to see these wrinkles form. Again, you have a thin sheet over here. A thin sheet is the epidermis, the skin. And as a function of age, it loosens and also changes its mechanical properties in terms of its adhesion to the substrate, and you get these wrinkles, which, of course, are a lot of people willing to pay a lot of money to get rid of. If I could actually figure out how to solve that problem, I wouldn't be here, but I only can tell you... I can only tell you how to make a theory of it, so that's not very useful. I'll come to that. So this is a painting, actually not a painting, a drawing by Leonardo da Vinci 500 years ago, and I think this exemplifies the kind of complexity that you see in these kinds of problems. So here you see a person's knee draped with a heavy piece of cloth, and that piece of cloth started out flat. And just by virtue of it being draped on the person's knee, you see this tremendous complexity in shape. You see that the sheet is flat in certain regions, then it comes together. Different parts of this piece of cloth come together along ridges, to use mountaineering terminology, and the ridges themselves meet at peaks. Okay, so the solution of the problem, which is the problem of draping, is essentially accomplished over here by a very heterogeneous, extremely non-uniform deformation of this thin sheet. And the question that one could ask is, you know, why does it do this? A more rough way of generating something like that, but permanently. I mean, with this, with a piece of cloth, you can take it out and it flattens. With a piece of paper, if you get angry after a calculation which doesn't work, which happens more often than one like to admit to, probably, this is the result. Again, a thin sheet which has a very, very complicated structure. And the question is, how did it get there? And can you essentially describe it at some theoretical experimental level? So that's on our scale. This is on a continental scale. And here is an example on the very small scale. This is essentially a multi-walled carbon nanotube. So a single layer of atom, a single layer of carbon essentially either wrapped around in a scroll or with concentric tubes, and it's essentially bent, and what you see are these little wrinkles at the bottom. And again, I want to emphasize the scale over here is a nanometer, a few nanometers, so orders of magnitude, 10, 12 orders of magnitude apart. What's going on? Is there some simple way of understanding this? And of course, I wouldn't be here if I didn't know or didn't think that there was a simple way, and that simple way actually goes back a long time, but the theory is rich enough, like, for example, the theory of hydrodynamics, that it actually will sustain us for actually a long time still. So what's the question? The question is to try and understand these patterns. The question is to try and understand also the fine scales that result. The wrinkles are very fine scales on a course when viewed from afar. You don't see them. When you go in close, you actually see them. How can we resolve these fine scales? And how can we resolve these near singularities? So these singularities associated with, for example, what happens when two ridges meet at a peak, either in a piece of cloth or something over here, or the cusp-like singularities that you see over there. So that's the question that I'd like to essentially try and address. And here's how I'd like to try and proceed. So I want to tell you a little bit about the geometry and the physics of thin sheets. And it's so simple that you would think that it should be possible to work out all the consequences, but I'm going to try and convince you it's not. And I'll do that first by essentially working out a very simple example of a carbon nanotube and the wrinkling on that. And then I'm going to tell you how we can use what we learn over there to make a more generalized theory of wrinkles on skins and maybe even elephant trunks. Then I want to tell you about a rather beautiful problem that we pay scant attention to, which is the problem that a tailor or a draper or a couturier has, which is how do I take a flat sheet of fabric and then drape something as complicated as a body. And I'm going to relate that to an extraordinarily beautiful theorem which goes back to Gauss, which is called, he was so proud of it that he actually called it the Theorema Egregium, actually a spectacular theorem. A theorem itself is supposed to come from God, from Theo. But in fact, he thought it was so powerful, so beautiful, that he said it's a very special theorem, and I'll connect it to some of the things that one can actually ask questions about. And then I'm going to end with even more questions that I started, which I suppose is what any project that we actually get involved in is supposed to do. So this is work that's ongoing, and started out actually with Enrique Cerda, who was a postdoc with me, is now in Chile. Sergio Rica, who's a collaborator of mine also in Chile, and most recently, Hai Liang, who's a postdoc with me. And all along, we had experimental collaborations with Jose Bico, Francisco Mello, Jan Genzer, and most recently, in the geological context, if I get to that, Rebecca Bendick, who's been trying to keep us on the straight and narrow from the geophysics point of view. Okay, so I want to tell you about a number of these questions, and in order to tell you about this, the first thing that's common to all the examples that I showed you on the very first overhead was the geometry of a flat sheet, a thin sheet. And so we know from elementary geometry that in order to characterize the shape of a thin sheet, a two-dimensional sheet in three dimensions, I need to essentially tell you how it's curved at every location. So I can basically tell you its curvature at every location, and because it's a flat sheet in two-dimensional flat sheet in three dimension, I have to tell you at every point how it's curved in one direction and how it's curved in an orthogonal direction. So these quantities, the curvatures, can be functions of location at from moving from one point to another, and they are called the principal curvature. So, for example, for our planet, to a first approximation, both the curvatures have the same sign, and for a potato chip, they don't have the same sign; they're opposite. And for a flat sheet, such as a piece of paper, in fact, both of them are zero. Equivalently, I could characterize the thin sheet in terms of not the principal curvatures, but in terms of what's called the mean curvature, the average of these two, and the product of these two. And again, for the relativists. And the geometers over here, these two are essentially the two invariants of the curvature tensor. So if I basically characterize the shape of a sheet in a two-dimensional sheet in three dimensions, then the curvature tensor in matrix notation basically has a structure of a 2x2 matrix, and this is the trace, and that's the determinant. And what Gauss taught us a long time ago was that of these two, this one actually depends on where the sheet sits, whether it sits in the two-dimensional sheet is in three dimensions or four and so on and so forth. It depends on the embedding space. But the Gauss curvature, the product of the two, is actually what's called an isometric invariant. And what does that mean? That means if I take a sheet of paper, and I realize that I should have brought a sheet of paper, but I don't, but I think I can find one. Oh, thank you. So if I take a sheet of paper and I bend it, then material on the top gets stretched a little bit, material at the bottom gets compressed, but the center surface doesn't change at all, okay? And if I basically have a sheet which I bend into a cylinder or I bend into a cone, that's the case for in one direction, but in the other direction, I don't have curvature at all. So for a cone, for example, it's not curved in this direction, but it's curved in this direction. A cylinder is just a generalization of a cone where the vertex has gone off to infinity, and there's a small generalization of that in mathematics, which I won't bother you with. But these deformations of a flat sheet into cylinders and cones and what are called developable surfaces preserve the metric. That means all points on the surface, on the mid-surface, essentially keep their length exactly the same as they were before they were deformed, and all lines essentially keep their angle relative to each other exactly the same. So the metric is preserved perfectly. And what Gauss told us was that if I have surfaces which I essentially deform by keeping their metric constant, then it immediately follows that the Gauss curvature is the same. So for a flat sheet of paper, the Gauss curvature, the product of the two curvatures is zero. For a cylinder, it's still zero because even though it's curved in one direction, it's not curved in the direction. And for a cone, it's the same as well. So the Gauss curvature is an invariant. That's a very, very powerful idea which we'll come back to again and again. And just to set our notation straight, especially for the students over here, for a saddle, the Gauss curvature is negative. For a flat sheet, it's zero. And for a sphere, it's essentially positive. Okay? So that's an intrinsic invariant. The mean curvature isn't. And as far as the geometry goes, if we know what the curvatures are at every location on the sheet, we know the shape. That's the end of the story. But that's not enough, because these objects that we're trying to understand are real objects. They are physical objects. And if they're physical objects, they have a finite thickness. It's not just an infinitesimal mathematical surface. So it has a finite thickness. And in fact, it has some properties, whether it's a fluid or whether it's a solid. It has some properties of the matter based on what the material is made of, based on what the sheet is made of. So I'm going to look at the limit, which is very reasonable, as I'll show you through examples, of the thickness compared to the size of the plate being very, very small. So the thickness divided by the length is much smaller than 1. And furthermore, even after it's deformed, it's such that the curvature is appropriately small. So the thickness times the curvature is still small. So in a different format, in a different notation, essentially this corresponds to wavelengths, which are deformations, which are of a long wavelength kind. So I have long wavelength deformations. And the question then arises, how do we essentially combine our knowledge of the geometry to the simple knowledge of the physical properties of a sheet that we are trying to describe? Maybe the crust of the earth, maybe the skin on your hand, whatever it is. So I know I can deform the surface by bending it, and I can deform the surface by essentially stretching it. And so there is, at the simplest level, characterization of that requires characterization of those two modes. So I can stretch it, and if I stretch it, at the very elementary level, the amount of material, the distance between two points is changed relative to the original distance is what we call the strain in I guess, freshman mechanics. Gamma, the change in length divided by L. And the energy, assuming that this whole thing is made of a bunch of tiny little springs, all of which are harmonic, would be the energy per unit area would be the strain squared multiplied by a property which is called the Young's modulus. That's a property of the material. And then because I want to characterize everything per unit area, integrate through the depth, so I get 1 power of the thickness, because I want to characterize everything in terms of the center surface itself. So the energy per unit area, assuming it's made of springs, is proportional to the square of the strain, written over here. That's a tangential mode. But there is another mode, which is telling you how the sheet moves in the dimension, in the third dimension, in which it's actually embedded. The two-dimensional surface is embedded in 3 dimensions. And so there's a transverse mode. And the transverse mode is simply characterized by asking how the sheet is curved. Okay, so how does the tangent essentially change its direction? And so the curvature is characterized by that change in direction, delta theta, compared to the distance that I've moved. So the curvature is delta theta over L. And the strain associated with that is simply proportional to the thickness. I use H over here rather than T. I notice that that's one place that should be a T. And that's because if I have a sheet which I essentially bend, and the sheet becomes thicker and thicker, the amount of material, the amount of stretch that I have simply scales with the thickness. So I have to stretch it more as I go further and further away. And of course, just like this quantity is dimensionless, that strain is also dimensionless because the curvature has dimensions of inverse length. So that strain is dimensionless. And again, we say that it's the object, if we assume it's made of a simple material where at the microscopic level I just have a bunch of springs, then the energy per unit area I can write exactly the same way as over here. The modulus integrated through the thickness, but now with this strain measure squared. And that strain squared gives me 2 more powers of the thickness, and so I get ET cube times the curvature squared. And this is the most profound and simplest thing simultaneously, okay? It's profound because it says that no matter what the material is made of, if I make the thickness small compared to this other aspect, the other dimensions of the sheet, this energy, if gamma is comparable to kappa, this energy is always going to be much larger than that because T is going to zero compared to L. That means it's very, very easy to bend a thin sheet compared to stretching it. And we know this from experience. It doesn't matter what the sheet is made of, whether it's metal, whether it's, in fact, even in terms of a liquid, I'll come to it later, rather than thinking about energies, you think about forces and strain rates. The same idea you can actually push through. The point being, it's easy to bend, it's difficult to stretch. And that's exactly why when I take a sheet of paper like this, very easy for me to bend it, very difficult to stretch it. And when I try to crumple it, I'll come back to that later also. When I try to crumple it, I'll do this now. And I open it out, you find that this thin sheet is actually flat almost everywhere, except along a set of points which are connected by lines. So it's a really simple observation, but it's extremely difficult, as I'll try and convince you, to try and explain. Okay, so the way I set it up, the way I set up the problem, this mode seems to be independent of that. But that's not true. And the reason it's not true is it's true if I bend a sheet into a cylinder, because I can bend it without stretching. I just told you that. I don't have to stretch the center surface. I have to stretch the top, compress the bottom, but the center surface remains the same. But if I try to deform a sheet into two curvatures, so if take a flat sheet and try to wrap the Earth, that's impossible. Again, that's essentially the reason why cartography was such a difficult problem to solve. Why is that impossible? Well, that's impossible because of this theorem, what Gauss told us. I can't map a sphere onto a flat sheet, and I can't take a flat sheet and map it onto a sphere unless I change the metric. Equivalently, if I have to change the metric, I have to change the angles and I have to change the lengths. That means it becomes a very, very expensive proposition. And that's precisely why a crumpled sheet actually deforms extremely heterogeneously. It doesn't want to stretch homogeneously everywhere because this energy is going to go through the roof. Okay? So there is a coupling of stretching to bending, and that comes via geometry, and it comes via geometry because taking a flat sheet and making a cylinder or a cone is one thing, but trying to essentially wrap it around something like a sphere is essentially impossible unless I change the Gauss curvature, but the Gauss curvature changes the changes in the Gauss curvature change the metric, and that makes this difficult. So this is where the nightmares lie, essentially, to try and understand the problem. So, all right. So you can write down a formulation, and I'm going to write down these equations only to show you the equations. I'll never essentially refer to them because they turn out to be impossible to solve analytically. There are no exact solutions. Okay, but they are related to equations that you might have seen elsewhere, particularly in relativity. So, questions. So in any of those problems that I showed you, is it stretching dominated? Is it bending dominated? Which means, is it dominated by what's happening in the plane or what's happening out of the plane? Or, as in a crumpled sheet, is it inhomogeneous? That's the question we want to ask. And formalizing that, I can either minimize an energy, which I've written down over here in terms of the components associated with the invariance. So if I have a two-dimensional surface, I told you can characterize it in terms of the curvature matrix or the curvature tensor, which has two invariants, the trace and the determinant. And similarly, for what is happening in the plane, I have a strain matrix or a strain tensor, and I can characterize that, the deformations of that, again, with respect to changes in the area and changes in length, so a trace and a determinant with some constants in front of that. Or I can write down equations of equilibrium by minimizing that variational problem with respect to change in the geometry where I take a flat sheet and I move it out of the plane. So x goes to x plus u, y goes to y plus v, and the flat surface goes to w. So geometry we know how to characterize. The physics is trivial. It's made of simple linear springs. The stress is proportional to the strain, written in tensorial form over there. And out of this come two equations, and let me just explain what they mean rather than worry about the details. The first equation is essentially an equation for the balance of forces out of the plane and effectively tells you how the mean curvature changes. And this, for those of you who remember from fluid mechanics, Laplace's law is just a generalization of Laplace's law, because it says that the pressure associated with the deformations in the plane are driven by something which looks, I've deliberately used this notation over here, surface tension times the curvature, except it's not a surface tension because unlike a fluid interface, a solid interface can have anisotropic forces. They can actually depend on the direction. And so it's the full stress tensor over here. But for a fluid interface, it would be just the curvature multiplied by the surface tension, which is the pressure. And this is the gory detail that essentially you have to deal with because you have an elastic sheet rather than a simple fluid interface. And the second equation also has a very beautiful meaning. It's actually, if you think in terms of electrostatics, if this was a potential, then the Laplacian of the potential is given by the charge. And over here, you have a geometric interpretation. The change in area of the sheet, which is related to the trace of the stress, is because the Gauss curvature is not zero. So this is exactly what Gauss told us, namely that if I take a flat sheet and I try to wrap it on a sphere, I have to pay a huge penalty associated with changing the line lengths. And this equation is exactly the equation, or has an analogy to electrostatics, where the charge is this geometric charge. It's the Gauss curvature. Okay, it's a purely geometric quantity. Nasty equations because they are coupled, they're nonlinear. There's a coupling over here, and there's this nonlinearity because the Gauss curvature is an inherently nonlinear quantity. They were written down 100 years ago, and as I told you, there are no solutions, exact solutions to this. except in very, very peculiar conditions. So what are you left with? So if you can't solve the problem exactly, you either do numerics or you do scaling and asymptotic analysis, and I'm going to spend the next half hour or so telling you about example after example. So we have a small parameter, which is the thickness divided by the length, and you can basically take that small parameter to zero, and I'm going to now show you a bunch of examples where either this term is effectively zero, so it's almost planar because if the curvature is zero, that means that the stress and the curvature are essentially orthogonal to each other, or the Gauss curvature is zero, and the Gauss curvature is zero is that it locally looks like a flat plane or looks like a cone or looks like a cylinder. So that's what I want to take away from this. I mean, the details of the equation are not as important as the physical content of the equations. So first problem, and in fact, you won't see these equations again. First problem I want to look at is the wrinkling of a carbon nanotube. And in fact, it turns out, so that's the nanotube that I showed you before. There was a nice paper published nearly a decade ago showing this, and they said, well, this is very, very interesting. We don't have a theory for it, and that's where it was. Then here is an experiment, done by me with a thin sheet of rubber. You roll up the rubber, and you roll up the rubber so that it forms a tube, a scroll rather than a tube, and you bend it. And when you bend it, you actually see wrinkles, exactly like this. I want to show you, 10 nanometers carbon, a few centimeters rubber, okay? What's going on? So I'm going to tell you that, in fact, you can understand this as you can understand a different problem. That's why I wore a sweater. So if I basically take my pullover, and I try to squeeze my pullover, there's a certain amount of slack in the pullover compared to my arm. If I start to squeeze the pullover relative to my arm, you see that it starts to wrinkle up, and there's a characteristic scale. So you get defects, but in fact, you nevertheless see a characteristic scale. And that's the experiment done a little more carefully over here. So it's the same scroll, but if instead of bending it, you just compress it, you get these ripples. So the question is, why do you get the ripples? Okay, so let's start with dimensional analysis. So if I have a large number of layers, then the only length scale in the problem, forgetting the lateral length scale, which you can clearly see is unimportant, is the thickness of one layer, which in the carbon nanotube is an atom, and the number of layers. Okay, so the number of layers, basically, if I know the radius of the tube, R is the number of layers multiplied by the thickness, and dimensional analysis tells me whatever that length scale is, that I actually see for the wrinkles must be T times some function of N. And the reason I don't have a dependence on the material properties is because whatever material property appears in the energy associated with bending appears in stretching also. So it should disappear. So that is what dimensional analysis would tell me without doing any work. So can we essentially do a little more work? And I want to qualitatively tell you how one can understand that. So I basically have these two components of the energy, which I already introduced, a bending energy and a stretching energy. Bending energy is penalized by very short wavelengths because short wavelengths have high curvature. So that's bad news. Okay? And that energy penalty is a modulus multiplied by the thickness cubed multiplied by the curvature squared. And then there's a stretching energy. Why is it stretch at all? Well, it stretches because if I have a cylinder and it bulges, then the radius changes. And if the radius changes, then the perimeter changes. And if the perimeter changes, it's stretched. So bending penalizes short wavelengths, stretching penalizes long wavelengths, because if I have a long wavelength bulge, I have to change the radius a lot or change the perimeter a lot. And so you have exactly what you need to get a competition between these two effects. So the stretching energy is ET times epsilon squared, where epsilon is the amount that I've swelled, the amplitude of the ripple divided by the radius of the tube, and the curvature is the second derivative, which is the amplitude divided by lambda squared. And finally, because I have two unknowns, an amplitude and a wavelength, I have actually to have one more equation because I just can't minimize this with two unknowns. And the other, the constraint is Pythagoras. Pythagoras basically tells us that when I take a flat sheet and I make it ripple, the length measured along the arc is the same as the length before. Okay? And that's this constraint over here. And that relates the amplitude to the wavelength by the amount that I've deformed it. And the amount that I've deformed it is the imposed curvature far away, the curvature kappa is imposed. And so when I substitute this relation into this energy, out comes what I claimed we should expect. The energy diverges when the wavelength goes to zero because curvature becomes very, very expensive to essentially penalize for short wavelengths. And it also diverges when the wavelength becomes very large because in that case, the stretching energy diverges. So you can see that there is a minimum for this energy if I basically take a derivative of that with respect to lambda. and you get a simple result. The wavelength is the geometric mean of the two scales in the problem, but since R is essentially the number of layers multiplied by the thickness, consistent with this dimensional argument over here, lambda goes as the square root of n times the thickness, and this is a nonlinear theory. It's not just a linear theory. It also predicts the amplitude. It predicts the amplitude because of Pythagoras, and Pythagoras is a nonlinear condition because it's essentially connecting squares of quantities, not linearly. And so it gives you the amplitude. A few things to point out. There is no dependence on the material properties. It becomes a problem in geometry. You get the amplitude and the wavelength, and as I said, then you should be able to test this. So here is data from the experiment with the rubber scroll plotted in bare units. Here is the data from the literature on carbon nanotubes. That straight line is not a fit. That's just taking the little scaling calculation that I told you about and doing it properly, okay, with all the prefactors which are known. So without a fit, you get this nanoscopic experiment to measure up against the macroscopic one. And if I do it a little more honestly and actually show you lambda divided by t as a function of n, the number of layers, now you start to see a small difference. That's the rubber data. That's the carbon nanotube data. And it's systematically over the rubber data. And the reason is because there are short-range interactions between the layers. It's not like the rubber, where in fact the layers are independent of each other. Over here, there is a short-range van der Waals interaction that actually stiffens the system, and therefore the wavelength goes up. And not only that, you can actually predict the amplitude as well. So again, without any fitting parameters, that's the line. This is where the rubber fits, and this is the data that we were able to extract from the literature. Okay. All right, so I want to summarize. This is a very long-winded example, I realize, but I want to summarize what we learned. I want to summarize what we learned from this very simple-minded example, and then I'll come to this. Okay? So we needed. So in fact, a theory of wrinkles is actually a theory of packing, but it's a theory of packing continuous objects. So we think of packing spheres, very old problem, very famous problem, only recently resolved in particular situations, and that only in infinite space. Here, the problem of wrinkling is essentially a response to a packing problem. I have a thin sheet, and I squeeze it from the sides, and it wants to respond. And if it's not able to respond on long wavelengths because of a constraint associated with, for example, a mattress of springs, all right, the mattress of springs was associated with this long wavelength deformation in the tube, then that penalizes lambda large, and lambda small, short wavelengths are penalized by a bending energy. So that's all we need, some packing condition, a bending energy penalty, which penalizes short wavelengths, and a mattress of springs, which penalizes long wavelengths. And there's a general theory that one can write down for the wavelength as a function of the bending stiffness, the mattress stiffness to the power 1/4, and it's nonlinear, so I can also predict the amplitude as a function of the amount of packing. So A is proportional to lambda. I show these over here not because I seriously consider that it can be applied to, for example, I forget what this is called. This is, I'm sure somebody over here will tell me the name. It's a dog, but what kind of dog? Okay. Somebody, I heard this. Sharpei, thank you. Yes. Okay. Lot of skin, lot of excess skin on a cylinder, so it's essentially the carbon nanotube problem. And this is the same thing over here for an elephant. And an elephant, of course, these wrinkles are very, very important because they allow it for tremendous flexibility. If I didn't, if I moved it in one direction, I'd stretch it enormously. If I moved it in another direction, I'd have problems. Okay. And these in fact, the muscular tissue and the skin is layered. So this is not, I say it somewhat frivolously, but somewhat seriously. I don't know. The answer is I don't know how much it could be relevant to this. Okay, so that's the first example. The second example, perhaps, one might care about a little more as one gets older, particularly, is wrinkling of skin. And wrinkling of skin can occur in compression, as when you try and furrow your forehead, and I don't know whether I have enough for you to see, but I don't want to know. Or I can wrinkle in tension. And that happens, for example, in the neighborhood of your eye. I particularly like this because these are self-similar. There's no scale in the problem. So there's a nice mathematical theory that one may be able to make for this. What's the difference? What's the difference between what I showed you before? Well, I've introduced some new physics, new constituents. First of all, skin is actually not just a single tissue. Skin consists of an epidermis, which sits on a dermis. So I have now a new length scale, which is the thickness of the dermis. I have a new material scale, which are the properties of the dermis. So the mechanical properties, the modulus of the dermis, and the length scale. And of course, I have previously also, just like in the carbon nanotube, a thickness of the epidermis and the modulus of the epidermis. And without thinking, if that general theory was relevant, then lambda would be this quantity where k is a mattress stiffness. And the mattress stiffness is, of course, in this case, a real mattress. It's the dermis. So the question is, what is the mattress stiffness? And again, from dimensional analysis, I can write the mattress stiffness as the modulus divided by some length scale multiplied by a function of two dimensionless parameters, which are the ratio of the modulus of this to that of the epidermis and the ratio of the wavelength to the characteristic depth of the dermis. Okay. So what is this length scale? That's the question. And I'm going to call this the persistence length. And the reason I'm going to call this the persistence length is because it asks the question, if I perturb the skin over a characteristic scale lambda, how far away do I actually feel it? Okay. So if I have deep dermis, which is what I have here, right? Then, in fact, when I actually perturb the skin, the influence is felt only over a scale comparable to the scale over which I'm perturbing it, because that's the only scale in the problem. While if I'm in the shallow water limit, to use hydrodynamic analogy, everything is cut off by the thickness that is associated with the dermis itself. Right? So in the deep water limit, I won't get into the details now. In the deep water limit, there is again only one scale in the problem, which is the thickness of the skin of the epidermis itself. So the wavelength should scale with the thickness, and it turns out with a couple of lines of algebra, you get the dependence on the ratio of the moduli to the 1/3. Now, if the ratio of the moduli, which we know, for epidermis, it's 1,000 times stiffer than the dermis, so that's a factor of 1,000 to the 1/3, so lambda is approximately 10 times the thickness. And this is an experiment which you can try. So if I look at wrinkles on the back of my hand, those wrinkles are pretty fine. Okay, they are on the millimeter scale. And the epidermis is 100 microns, so that's about right. So wrinkles over here are not very visible. And of course, therefore, you don't want to pay any money to essentially get rid of them. But if, on the other hand, you are in the shallow water limit, why didn't the shallow water limit come up? Okay, the shallow water limit, lambda is much larger than L. So this L is small, lambda is large. Where does that happen? Well, that happens when you're close to bone. So over here, you're not close to bone. So the effect of just moving the skin close to the bone stiffens. That's because the amount of material that you have between the skin and the bone is small, and therefore, even though the actual property is not large, actual stiffness is not very high, it actually becomes very stiff because you come very close to the bone. Okay? So you can do the calculation there as well, and again, I'll just quote the result. Lambda now is the geometric mean, like you saw in the carbon nanotube example, of the two scales in the problem, the thickness and the depth, and now is proportional to the ratio of the moduli but to the 1/6th power. So that's 1,000, so 1,000 to the 1/6th is a factor square root of 10. And now you can do another experiment. So now you can do it at the back of your hand. So if I do it at the back of my hand, I see how the wrinkles become very, very visible. Now it's the back of your, so it's close to the bone, very visible, and you see the characteristic wavelength is the order of a few millimeters. Okay? So how do I know what T and L are? Well, the epidermis is very thin compared to the dermis, so in order to find the epidermis plus the dermis, I just pinch it. And if I pinch it, I get essentially exactly the same order of magnitude as the wrinkle wavelength. And that's consistent because this gives you a square root of 10, and L itself is a 1 over square root of 10, and L itself gives you a square root of 10, and so that essentially cancels out. And so I get lambda over L is of the order of 1. And that's something you can check. So I pinch at the back of my hand, and I see how the pinch, what the size of the pinch is, which is essentially the thickness of the epidermis plus the dermis, and that's comparable to the wrinkle wavelength that you see. Now it becomes visible, and it becomes visible again purely for geometric reasons, not because of the material properties, but for geometric reasons. And that's why it's visible. So near anywhere where there is a skeleton, you essentially stiffen, and therefore you get large wrinkles. And that's why you pay lots of money. Well, not yet for me, but you will eventually. Okay, so in addition to amusing oneself, in fact, a friend of mine, Jan Genzer, who's a chemical engineer, said, well, maybe we can use this for something. And so here I want to show you, he's been making diffraction gratings, which are tunable. Okay, they are essentially wrinkled substrates. And the way he did the experiment was to essentially take a thin layer of polymer and then shine UV on it when it's stretched. And then when he shone UV on it, the surface cross-linked. And when the surface cross-linked, there was a thin skin, and then he let it relax. And when he let it relax, he found little wrinkles, but then he relaxed it some more, those little wrinkles saturated, and then he got bigger wrinkles, inside which there were little wrinkles, and then he saturated, and then he relaxed it some more, and he got even bigger wrinkles. So you got this matryoshka kind of a structure where wrinkles lie within wrinkles, In fact, he was able to find six orders of wrinkles going from the 10 nanometer scale all the way to a millimeter scale. And this straight line is a prediction from the theory, which says that the wavelength is proportional to the amplitude, and the constant of proportionality is just the amount of strain that you induce in the whole problem. Okay, so he wants to use this now to actually make, as I said, controllable diffraction gratings, but also a sorting object. So if I basically put down cells or if I put down particles, different size particles will essentially sit in different kinds of wrinkles, and maybe you can use this. I don't know. Okay, so I've told you about nanotubes. I've told you about skin. Those are one-dimensional. So it's a cellular pattern where essentially things are varying only in one dimension, nothing's varying in another direction. I want to tell you now about a different problem, which may not look like this at all, but in fact I'm going to claim does. Origami. Okay, so what's origami? So origami, from our perspective, is essentially the ability or the inability, if you don't succeed, in trying to essentially fold a piece of paper into a creased structure so that the creases are put in at the right place at the right time. So spatial and temporal ordering are very, very important, as you know, if you ever tried to make a crane or a frog or anything like that. Because if I don't have the right fold at the right time, the system gets frustrated. I have to open it and then refold it. And I also have to have the right fold at the right place, because otherwise also the system gets frustrated. So we've been practicing origami for maybe a few hundred years, and so we think that we are very clever and very intelligent and so on and so forth. And in fact, I'm going to tell you that that's all very nice, but it's not true. Okay? Plants have been doing it for much longer, if this ever works. Okay. So that gave it away, so let me try again. Okay, so another problem associated with origami is to do with map folding. Now, I know this is the 21st century, and so we don't use maps, we use GPS devices. But there was a time when people used maps in cars, and it was very easy to unfold a map. And the reason it was very easy to unfold a map is because you just unfolded it one fold at a time. All right? So if I had n folds, refolding it is a problem because there are two possibilities for every fold. So there are 2 to the n possibilities. Of course, that leads to a lot of frustration of various kinds. Okay? So I want to tell you that human beings have been the most stupid in terms of designing maps. And the reason for that is because there's only one way in which you can fold a map so that the folds are actually decoupled. And that's when the folds are all orthogonal to each other. Any other way that you essentially try and fold a piece of paper, the folds will be coupled together. And if they are, in fact, then you can open and fold the map in one movement. So instead of having 2 to the n possibilities, you just have a single one. Right? And a Japanese engineer seems to have essentially made a tidy profit on that. So Miura, after whom this is called Miura Ori. Ori is fold, and gami or kami is actually paper, devised this structure. And I have a model over there. So this is the structure that he has. And as you can see, I can open it in one movement. Okay, so I can open it in one movement, and I can close it in one movement. So the folds are coupled. And you can actually buy these, I think, in Tokyo. There are street maps and also subway maps, which you can find. And so, as I said, he thought he invented it in the 1970s. And then you looked out of the garden, maybe this time of the year, especially over here, and you find that, in fact, plants have essentially designed and have come to this evolutionary accident, not intelligent design, basically in the hornbeam and a whole bunch of other situations. So over here, you see exactly the same structure, right? Well, so you can ask a teleological question. You know, how did they stumble on it, and why is it useful? Well, why it's useful is obvious, because essentially, if I have a bud and the bud wants to bloom, then it's easy for the whole thing to bloom by essentially filling with water, by hydrating it. All right? So I can basically deploy the whole structure simultaneously rather than open one fold at a time, which is what you used to do when you were in the car trying to unfold your map. So question, what's going on? Can we understand this? And this is one of these beautiful accidents that we all like to happen often to us. At the Cavendish Lab, in Athene Donnell's group, I don't know why this is acting up. Okay, Rosalba Rizzieri was essentially drying Jello, and one day she showed me this pattern. All right. So this is drying Jello, and she showed me this, and she said, I don't know what's going on. And I said, well, I think I know what's going on. It's essentially tried to do this, which is, of course, trying to do this, but in a natural physical system. Okay, so how is it happening? So I won't get into the details, But what's happening is that you can use, this is a system where a thin skin is essentially contracting in all directions simultaneously, okay? Because it's drying up. It dries up, and as it dries up, the surface turns out to go through a glass transition, so it becomes much stiffer, so it really forms a skin. So as it dries up, you have now a wavelength, which I told you about previously, which essentially comes up naturally when I compress it. But there's a problem of the wave vector, because the wave vector can point in any direction. So if I have a large system, then the wave vector just arbitrarily points in one direction, based, for example, on a defect or a boundary condition or something like that. Okay, unfortunately, that's not good enough, because that's relaxed the strain. So if I have a little set of wrinkles this way, it's relaxed the strain in this direction, but it's done nothing to the strain in that direction. So then there is still strain left in this direction, and so I have to relax that. So one possibility is for this whole thing to buckle out of the plane. But now we go back and remember Gauss, or physics based on Gauss. And Gauss taught us, well, it's already curved in this direction. If I curve it in this direction, very bad news, because then I have to change the metric. And if I have to change the metric, that costs me a lot of energy. So what's the other solution? Well, the other solution is to basically say, if I want to relax the strain in this direction, I just have to tilt. But if I tilt it in one direction, I could just as well tilt it in another direction. And so if I can accommodate the strain by tilting, so that's my original cellular pattern of wrinkles. If I tilt it in one direction and tilt it in another direction, it's completely equivalent. But of course, that's not allowed unless I put in defects. And if the energy associated with the defects grows sublinearly, then I win, because this structure has lower energy than having to buckle it out of the plane in one direction in response to the strain in that direction. And that's exactly what's true. So I will show you in a little bit why the energy is sublinear. In fact, it's actually logarithmic. And again, for those of you in fluid dynamics, in fact, it turns out that you can essentially start with the equations of elasticity and derive an equation which people first derived in fluid mechanics to understand how cellular patterns in convection also show what are called zigzag instabilities. And what I'm telling you is that the zigzag instability that's well known in fluid mechanics, if you translate it to solid mechanics, is origami. Okay? And it suggests that this is a very clever way for morphogenesis. In other words, the leaf really doesn't have to build any of this like Murat did. All it needs is differential growth, and this differential growth will spontaneously give you these patterns for free. You don't have to have any large-scale organizational principle. You just need minimization of elastic energy subject to differential growth. Now, we don't know that's true in this system, but we do know in other systems this is turning out to be actually a reasonable way to think. Okay, so that's a two-dimensional instability. I want to tell you about draping, because I said I would, at least very quickly. So we were inspired, this is work with Enrique, said that we were inspired by this book when we started out thinking about it, and it's got this wonderful title, Dynamic Wrinkles and Drapery by Bernd Hogarth. I don't know, at least the people in the first row may be able to see this inset. Can you recognize who this is? Anybody in the first row who's older than me? It has to be older than me. I don't think. That's Tarzan. And Bernd Hogarth was the original illustrator of Tarzan. And he wrote this book and a series of other books in order to circumvent or overcome a problem before computers and before animation, is how to somehow show dynamic activity using static images. Well, one way is to basically have a whole bunch of them and you flip through them. But the other way is to show the amount of tension that there is in a person by showing what's happening to the clothes that they're wearing. Right? And so he basically said, look, if I understand the way in which a drape is essentially covering clothing a person, I may be able to use that to depict particular kinds of movements. And he distinguished these drapes into draping, if you like, a point or a zero radius waist, a line, which I guess you don't have curtains anymore, but if you have often at home curtains where you have pinches which are deliberately induced at the top, and of course you see a reverse cascade, for those of you in fluid mechanics, an inverse cascade where the wavelength increases, or you can drape a circle, an arc. So you can drape a point, a straight line, or a curve. And the question is, how can you understand any of these? And I won't get into the details, except to point out that there is another new length in the problem that's come, because you've introduced gravity now. Okay, so if you've introduced gravity, there is a balance between elasticity and gravity, which gives you a characteristic length, which for a sheet of rubber is of the order of centimeters. And gravity is the spring. Now, what do I mean by that? So the drape wants to hug the object. So in the case of a point, for example, it wants to be as vertical as possible. But there's an issue because I have a lot of perimeter. So one possibility is I wrinkle it into a very, very fine, large number of wrinkles. That's very expensive because bending is very expensive. The other possibility is to come out, but if it comes out, then gravity is actually, you're fighting gravity. Your potential energy is not as low as possible. So there's a competition between these two effects. And that gives you, using the formula that I showed you before, a dependence on the macroscopic length of the problem, which is the size of the sheet, and the characteristic length scale introduced by gravity in the problem. Okay, so what can you do with that? So the number of folds is just the perimeter divided by the wavelength, and the only point to be made over here is that it goes with a positive power. So as the skirt becomes longer, the number of folds increases, and we know this. And here is an exponent, which actually you can predict, which hasn't been checked experimentally, but that's what you get. What about for a line? Well, for a line, the number of folds, let me just put it out, is the width divided by the wavelength, but the wavelength is proportional to L to the 1/4, so the number of folds decreases as you increase it. And this also we see. As I make it longer and longer, it decreases, which makes a lot of sense, because as I go and make an infinitely long sheet, it's completely forgotten what's happening over there. It just remains straight. And what do you see over here? Again, you see that instead of moving smoothly from n to n over 2 to n over 4 or whatever it is, it happens discretely, and it happens discretely through these singularities again that I showed you before, okay? These defects which essentially come in the zigzag pattern. And this may explain, not that he cares, why Christo essentially had to have guy ropes when he draped the Reichstag and other buildings, because if he didn't, you'd lose the wrinkles, okay? And again, as I said, from a hydrodynamic point of view, this is amusing because this is an inverse cascade. You start with a large number, and as you go further and further down, you lose them. Okay. Probably now we'll move 17 at one time. Okay. So, all right. So you can do this a little more in a sophisticated way. I don't want to tell you anything about this except to point out that this is the reason why video gamers have such a hard time trying to simulate drapes. Okay, so if you basically play a video game, you see all these creatures fighting each other. So one reason not to have clothes is to make sure that they fight each other, and then you just give them armor. So you don't have to worry about real-time simulation. Another reason is, in fact, you have a tremendous multi-stability. You can have large number of shapes which are very close together energetically, but very different in shape. Okay, money to be made. I'll just give you two examples of this. So almost similar initial conditions. In one case, you have essentially bilateral symmetry. In another case, you've essentially broken bilateral symmetry in one direction, but you keep it in the other direction. Okay, so I'm almost out of time. The harder problem, and I'll use the resort of the scoundrel, crumpling. You want to basically describe it. You want to give something, some description of the statics, some description of the dynamics, and a glib answer is, well, I know what the energy is, I know what the constraints are, I minimize it. And it turns out to be harder to do than to say. And I already told you about why, because I told you that the sheet wants to remain flat, then it wants to bend, but it wants to remain bent by keeping the Gauss curvature constant, and the original constant is zero, so it's isometric, and only then will it bend and stretch. And when it bends and stretches, it does so very inhomogeneously. So that's how it happens, I've told you this before. So a crumpled surface, if you think about it, is a remarkable surface because it's flat almost everywhere except along a set of measure zero, where you have lines coming together at points. So it's really, really innocuous problem with the minimum amount of physics we don't know how to do. We really don't have any idea how to essentially understand that. But we have some glimpses, okay? And the glimpses are associated with trying to understand, I suppose, the hydrogen atom. Okay, so if I think of a crumpled sheet, this is the hydrogen atom. This is the single defect solution. I can't essentially have something which is axisymmetric because that doesn't preserve the metric. And so I break O2 symmetry and I get Z2 symmetry. All right. Now, it's essentially not been stretched anywhere except near the tip. So that's the element, that's the minimal element. Now, if I want to go to the next one, well, I have one more. But now you see I've developed something new. I have a structure which corresponds to what looks like will eventually become a ridge. That's helium. And so on, okay? So a sheet of paper essentially is a combination, a collection of defects, and these defects interact with each other non-linearly in order to give rise to the structure that the piece of paper is. We and others, Tom Witten's group in particular, have looked at how these things actually work in the context of a single defect and the context of two defects. And there are some numerical simulations which people are now trying to do to understand this. I think suffice it to say that very much an open question. I won't tell you the results, but I will tell you something else. So we know how to do one, we know how to do two. We'd like to go to many, we don't know. So as I said, I will be a scoundrel and I will just copy Jonathan Swift, who was copied by Lewis Fry Richardson. And I'll say that what really happens is that big crumples fold into little crumples that store energy in bending. And little crumples have lesser crumples and so on to stretching, because the stretching is localized in the neighborhood of the ridges and in the neighborhood of the vertices. Everywhere else, it's essentially bending. So you have a cascade. You're dumping in energy on the large scale, but it's a nice variational problem because you have an energy. It's not a dynamical problem. But nevertheless, it's really difficult because of impenetrability, because of the constraint that no part of the sheet can go through any other part of the sheet. That's why these have distributions. That's why, in fact, the distance between points has actually got a non-trivial distribution. Otherwise, what will happen is if I crumple it and there's a phantom membrane, all the defects will move to the boundary because that's where they are far furthest from each other. So it's the topological constraint of impenetrability and this nasty singularity associated with having small regions where a lot of energy is focused, which leads to this difficulty. Okay, all right, so that's where we are. Okay, so in fact, I showed you that elastic solids do this, but there's a beautiful analogy that goes back to the Stokes' original paper from 1847, which allows you to do technology transfer. If you solve one problem, in fact, you actually have a solution of two problems. And that's associated with an analogy which says that a solid and a liquid, at least in the linear regime, and we are in the physically linear regime, we are in the geometrically nonlinear regime. In the physically linear regime, I just replace the displacement by a velocity, a strain by a strain rate, and if I have an incompressible solid and an incompressible fluid, I just have one material constant, a shear modulus for the solid and a shear viscosity for the fluid, then the equations are identical. I just have this mapping. But of course, our problem is more complicated because if I have a thin sheet of fluid, I also have surface tension, and so in order to make the analogy exact for thin sheets of fluids vis-a-vis thin sheets of solid, then I have to have this quantity called the capillary number, which measures the ratio of viscous stresses to surface tension, also become very large. So surface effects are very, very small. And there's a whole slew of phenomena which actually you see in fluids, including this one over here, which Will, Arvi, and I worked out 10 years ago now, maybe something like that, on how honey might coil and so on. So this happens in two dimensions. You can get bicycle wheel spoke patterns, or it happens with bubbles. When bubbles collapse, you get these iris-like patterns and so on and so forth. Okay, so I want to finish by telling you about whether or if maybe this might apply, in fact, to a global scale. So 2 minutes, if I have. So the radius of our Earth is a few thousand kilometers. The thickness of the crust varies, but it's of tens of kilometers. So there's, again, this wonderful separation of scale. There is a characteristic radius divided by the thickness, which is of the order of a hundred or so. So what's the question? To which the answer is no. That escaped me. Okay. The question is the shape of island arcs. Okay. So this is Alaska, these are the Aleutian Islands, that's Japan, South China Sea, Indonesia, other parts in Scotia, probably South America over here, something off the coast of Australia. So you have arcs associated with how these islands are typically arranged. Not always. For example, over here you see a straight line. And what can we say about this? Well, in fact, there have been many people before us, in particular, a very interesting paper by Charles Frank. So I want to point out some things. I guess I should have. These subduction zones are fairly narrow, As I said, they're arc-like most of the time, but sometimes straight. And I forgot to point out something very important. They have a polarity. So if I have spreading from a ridge, they always are convex with respect to that direction. And not a new problem. And again, many people have looked at this. And my own introduction to this was through a paper which is twice as long as that paragraph, the entire paper, published in Nature by Charles Frank, who in fact was one of the among many other things, worked out the structure of how crystals grow and how to think about liquid crystals as new phases of matter and so on. And he basically suggested an analogy to a ping pong ball, which is what you see over here, a ping pong ball which is everted partially. So it's essentially reversed its curvature, and the ridge along which it reverses its curvature has a particular radius, and he related the angle through which you have everted the sphere to the ratio of the radius that you form compared to the radius of the Earth. And he said, this is not an unreasonable place, an unreasonable way to think about what's happening. Okay? That's a purely geometric theory. Of course, if it's relevant at all, and there are reasons why it might be relevant, associated with what I just showed you, given that I have this spherical, to a first approximation spherical Earth with a thin sheet which is trying to subduct because of negative buoyancy, there are reasons why it won't work as well, and the reasons why it won't work are manifold. Okay? You don't necessarily have a complete spherical cap, you have a finite thickness, you have a complicated rheology, you have a mantle, variable buoyancy, all kinds of things. So many people have done this. In particular, recently, there have been lots of numerical simulations. And all that I want to say is that, in fact, we can essentially use the Stokes-Rayleigh analogy and solve the problem in two different limits, the viscous and the elastic limit. And the thing to point out is something which I believe you will all agree with, which is first that there is a free or a very soft edge associated with where the subduction is happening, if you assume that the subduction has already started. And if it's free, by definition, it's easier to fall over there. That's what it means for it to be free of external. And it's also negatively buoyant over there because it's the oldest part of the crust. And so what's going to happen? So if I have, if I had subduction of a flat sheet moving into a mantle, then there's no reason why any scale will be set in the transverse direction, the lateral direction. It can happen any way I want. And in fact, there have been simulations which show that it folds back and forth, just like these experiments that I showed you with soap films. But if it happens on a curved Earth, there's a problem, because I essentially am moving from a radius r to a radius which is slightly smaller. And I have all this excess perimeter that I have to account for. And so I have two possibilities. One possibility is to deform the mantle. That's not easy. It's difficult if I think about the elastic limit. It's also very slow if I think about it viscously. So that's the Stokes-Rayleigh analogy. On the other hand, very short wavelengths, very bad, because it essentially penalizes the crust deformation. So again, we have this competition. But I have to accommodate all this excess area. And I will only show you the results of a very, very simple scaling analysis, which seems to be consistent with a more sophisticated numerical calculation. And the scaling is associated with penalizing, and again, I can translate all this, I want to emphasize, to a viscous model, but it's easy to think in terms of energy for the elastic model. I penalize the bending of the lithosphere, the crust, the stretching, because if I go from a radius r to a slightly smaller radius, I have to essentially potentially contract the amount of area, and then the deformation of the mantle. And out of this, you see that the wavelength dependence is, in one case, 1 over lambda, in the other case, lambda and lambda. So balancing or minimizing this energy, or equivalently writing down a force balance equation and then calculating, doing linear stability analysis to ask which wavelength grows the fastest, gives you potential a simple expression for the wavelength in terms of the properties of the lithosphere, if it's assumed to be elastic, the thickness of the lithosphere, and the properties of the mantle. Or if it's viscous, then the viscosity of the mantle. And I know, and I completely agree, that this is extremely simple-minded, because the mantle and the crust have much more complicated rheologies. But that's what it gives you. And if you put in what people report as numbers, and I don't know whether to believe them or not, I'm simply quoting numbers which people have reported. I think that one shouldn't take this too seriously. Let me click on this. OK. You get the wavelength to be of the order of less than 1,000 kilometers, 500 kilometers or so, and it suggests that the number essentially varies from 1 to 5. So that's the best that you can do with this kind of model. You can do a more complicated calculation, but it's one step beyond what Frank did, and somehow intermediate between these kinds of very geometric models and a full-blown numerical simulation. What's the problem with the model? The problem with the model is that even though it predicts all these things, unfortunately, this instability, if you do it carefully, is subcritical. So if I have a small change, then it comes back. If I have a large change, it runs away. And that's the big problem, unfortunately, because then I don't know whether we should trust anything. In other words, initial conditions essentially are crucial, and we just don't know what those were. Okay, so I'm out of time, and I'd like to stop. More than anything else, I hope I've tried, I have convinced you that it's extraordinarily simple physics, just springs, but geometry. And then you get this tremendous richness in the kinds of problems that you can look at. And I have barely begun to scratch the surface. Okay. Here's the class of problems that I haven't even talked about. What happens if I start with something which is not flat? Again, if you wait for a few weeks and you go out into your garden and see flowers and petals in particular, you see they have a tremendously rich morphology. In this case, this is actually a beautiful model made by Diana Taimina, a mathematician at Cornell, of what's called a hyperbolic plane. I'm happy to talk to this about this to people. So this is an old question addressed by first, I think, Klein and then Poincaré. And then definitively shown that you can't essentially embed a surface with constant negative Gauss curvatures, okay? So something which looks like a potato chip, you can't embed it in three dimensions. If you want it to be complete, which means it's either closed or it has very well-behaved boundaries, and if it's analytic, there's a theorem. But that doesn't prevent nature from essentially making patches of it, small pieces. How do we describe these? So there are attempts that various people are involved in right now. I won't tell you about them. We are as well trying to play with that. What happens if I introduce cuts and tears and stitches, like a tailor does? Okay. So with George Whiteside, we've been trying to make three-dimensional circuits. Start with something flat, have magnets, get the whole thing to assemble in three dimensions. And as it assembles, what's the optimal way to cut so that I essentially have a final state? That's what a surgeon tries to do, and a surgeon is able to do that empirically, but can we essentially be of help? And then I didn't tell you anything about dynamics. Okay, and I'll show you a little experiment. This is an experiment. It's not a calculation. This is at 10,000 frames a second, and it was motivated by another innocuous question. When you open your newspaper, if you again are not a 20th century type, or if you are a 20th century type and you don't read everything on the web, if you open a newspaper, you essentially move your hands at centimeters a second, but you hear it. So somehow there is this, again, incredible magnification of motion, which essentially is occurring at centimeters a second, is able to generate an acoustic impulse, which generates then frequencies in the audible range. So how is that happening? The same thing happens when I crumple a piece of paper. Okay. So how does that happen? Well, in a nutshell, it happens because you essentially have regions of one curvature and another essentially popping. And as they pop, they generate waves. And that's an experiment. Again, I'm happy to talk to people about that. Let me see if I can go back and get the movie to run again. Okay, so that's a single defect, which is essentially two of these what I call developable cones moving. And as they move, they essentially exit the system and the whole system rings. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much.